From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the latest as SNAP benefits expire. Then Ron Elving on the Week in Politics. Also, the tech industry frets about AI making messages sound too perfect. Matthew Reese in a new film where parents get a 2 a.m. phone call and drive off into the darkness.
The truly frightening element to me was this wasn't something phantasmic. It was the true great horror of what do you do for your child in these extreme situations.
And then B. Wilson's new memoir of the feelings that old kitchen implements can stir up. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, November 1, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Star Tribune has confirmed that Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested 8 unauthorized immigrants in Hibbing on Wednesday. In a news release, the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office said the arrest came during a drug-related search warrant. The Sheriff's Office says in September, an undercover officer bought cocaine from someone who lived and worked at the location on the 1800 block of 3rd Avenue East, which is La Tequila Taco Shop. A man was arrested on suspicion of third-degree sale of cocaine and possession of a firearm by an ineligible person. The man also had several fake identification documents, according to the sheriff's office. The release further stated that the sheriff's office was aware that federal law enforcement, quote, took additional actions during the search warrant, but did not provide any more information. Authorities at the scene included the Hibbing Police Department, U.S. Border Patrol, Drug Enforcement Administration, Enforcement and Removal Operations, and Homeland Security Investigations. Federal agents were also seen at another Mexican restaurant, El Charro Mexican Bar and Grill. Governor Tim Walz's announcement of a pause in payments for 14 Medicaid programs in Minnesota caused widespread confusion and anxiety among people who provide services to the elderly and disabled. The Walz administration announced Wednesday that the governor ordered a, quote, pause on all payments for 14 DHS Medicaid services until an audit is complete. The Minnesota Reformer reports that providers and Democratic legislators reacted with alarm, given the prospect of unpaid caregivers and vulnerable Minnesotans shut out of life-saving services. The Department of Human Services clarified that each payment will undergo a review and only be paused for up to 90 days if, quote, an anomaly is detected and needs to be reviewed further. If the review determines the bill is fraudulent, it will not be paid. The snafu comes as Walz seeks to get ahead of the fraudsters who have bilked state and federal programs out of hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years, as well as Republican attacks on the fraud issue, which are already incoming as Walz begins a race for a third four-year term. A DHS statement to providers on Wednesday stated that there still may be payment processing delays, but the payments pause is not as all-encompassing as providers feared from the news release. The governor's office defended the language of the release to the Minnesota Reformer. Health coverage affordability is top of mind for many Minnesotans. Officials with the state's insurance marketplace say it's reasonable to be worried about what lies ahead, but trusted navigators can still potentially find savings and help avoid pitfalls. November 1st is the enrollment start date for people who get their coverage through MNsure, which is Minnesota's insurance exchange through the Affordable Care Act. Enhanced federal subsidies that keep costs lower expire at year's end as that debate plays out in Congress. MNsure's Mary Robinson says whether it's the larger tax credits or changes to insurance plans, people should look into their options as soon as possible.
Even if you've been in the same plan for years, don't just hit repeat. There may be a better fit for your needs and your budget.
If the tax credits expire, some 19,000 MNsure enrollees will lose all financial help. But nearly 70,000 still may qualify for subsidies, albeit at a reduced level. So Robinson says it's important to not immediately think the worst and connect with a local trusted broker or navigator by searching MNsure's directory. She says the free guidance will steer you in the right direction and avoid scammers or online influencers promoting too-good-to-be-true plans and premiums. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. A new nonprofit aimed at strengthening the vitality of downtown Grand Rapids is beginning a branding process. In a news release, the Grand Rapids Downtown Alliance says it will serve as a connector for those who share a vision for a thriving, welcoming downtown. The planning and development for the Alliance is being fully funded with a startup grant from the Blandon Foundation. The branding effort will culminate in a new visual identity and messaging strategy to guide future marketing, programming, and investment efforts. The organization is also hiring an executive director. Amid one of the longest government shutdowns in U.S. history, causing disruptions to food support, our news team put together a list of food-related resources across the region. Find it on our homepage at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. There are no SNAP food benefits for millions of Americans today for the first time since the country's largest anti-hunger program began six decades ago. On Friday, two federal judges said the pause was likely to be unlawful. President Trump says he's open to keeping SNAP going despite the government shutdown. But it is not clear how or when that might happen. NPR's Jennifer Ludden joins us. Jennifer, thanks for being with us.
Hi there.
Trump administration says there's just no money available to fund SNAP. What did both of the federal judges say about that?
Well, they said Congress has provided more than $5 billion in emergency funds, and it's for exactly this kind of situation. They rejected the administration's argument that it cannot legally use that. They said it not only can, but must. In Rhode Island, Judge John McConnell Jr. called for this to happen as soon as possible. The other judge, Indira Talwani in Boston, said officials could also tap more money from customs revenue, but she left that decision up to them. Both judges gave the administration until Monday to come back with a plan for how it will proceed.
But does this mean that people who count on this assistance might see it sometime soon?
That is a good question, and the only answer right now is we really don't know. I mean, first, will the administration appeal? Second, if they agree to only tap the contingency funds, that falls well short of SNAP's November budget, which is $9 billion. So the people would not get the full amount they qualify for. And in that case, the administration has said, you know, calculating partial payments is a logistical nightmare that could take time, especially in the middle of a shutdown. And then for President Trump, a few hours after these rulings, he addressed them in a social media post. He said he's instructed his lawyers to clarify with the court how they can legally fund SNAP. And if they do, he said, it will be my honor to provide funding just like I did with the military and law enforcement pay.
If the administration decides to pay people at least some part of their regular SNAP food benefits, how would that break down? How would it work?
We really don't know. Again, this has not happened before. I've not seen a public plan for how to do it. I did speak, though, with an Agriculture Department employee who works on SNAP, and they agreed it would be challenging and even beyond logistics. This person asked me not to use their name for fear of retribution, and also they're not authorized to speak with media. But they said, for one thing, if you have partial funding, do you give it only to the most needy? Or do you give people, you know, half their regular amount, maybe three quarters? And states would want to say in that. But also, how do you divide partial funding among states? And the employee wondered if this administration might decide to give some states more SNAP money than others.
And Jennifer, where does this leave the millions of people who aren't getting federal food aid beginning today?
Scott, it leaves them in need. You know, it is a lot of money that is disappearing from people's food budgets. We don't know for how long. Food policy experts say no amount of amping up food banks can come anywhere close to making up this difference. But of course, it does help. And we see more states and cities shifting money for it. Soon after yesterday's rulings, Oklahoma's governor announced a vote to send $1 million a week to food banks for SNAP recipients for up to 7 weeks if needed.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
What do you believe are the political calculations of the Trump administration when it comes to SNAP benefits?
No one wants to be in charge when families are forced to go without food. But here we have the Trump administration going to some lengths to find $5 billion to pay the military, while refusing to take a similar amount from a contingency fund specifically meant for food assistance. They call that a rainy day fund for a hurricane or an earthquake, but two federal judges have now said it sure looks like an emergency to them. So now Trump says maybe his lawyers can find a way to release the money after all. And when you think about it, this comes in the same news cycle with release of photos of new gold fixtures in the White House bathrooms and news stories about a lavish Great Gatsby party at Mar-a-Lago last night hosted by the president. Not great optics.
The Senate Majority Leader John Thune once more rejected the president's call to eliminate the filibuster. The president sees that as a way of ending the government shutdown on his terms. But his Republican allies in the Senate resist his call. Why is that?
The filibuster, that 60-vote requirement in the Senate, empowers the minority party regardless of which party that is. And Republicans have long memories. They know they could be back in the minority again themselves someday, maybe fairly soon. And they can easily imagine Democrats with a Senate majority making major moves such as expanding the Supreme Court or granting statehood to the District of Columbia, things the filibuster has prevented in the past. Now, presidents, of course, have long chafed at the filibuster, and Trump is no exception. It's a barrier to his program in the present, and that matters more to him than what might happen to the Senate in some future situation years from now.
Of course, Ron, President Trump returned from a tour of Asia this week. Would you call the trip a success?
It certainly looked like a success. Not just the public spectacles, but also the pile of trade deals and other negotiations that seemed to be successfully completed. Now, we've also seen that with Trump and trade, much that seems set can shift. That's part of what he seems to like about tariffs. He can impose them and then change them at will. He's done that many times. And the current Congress has not yet chosen to assert its own role and rein him in. So tariffs become tools for his personal manipulation, which plays to his strengths as a negotiator and as a showman. All the same, there would seem to be real gains made on this trip in terms of securing strategic materials and also in de-escalating the talk of trade war with China. That's certainly good news for business and worldwide. Trump also worked hard on this trip to burnish his credentials as a peacemaker, witnessing the signing of a deal between Thailand and Cambodia over border disputes and so on. He was plainly displeased, however, that the whole trip got upstaged by the government shutdown at home.
Of course, open enrollment begins today in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. It's going to be on the minds of a lot of people this weekend, isn't it?
Yes, it is. All of Washington and the media have been talking about these Obamacare subsidies for months now, but we tend to forget that a large percentage of Americans have yet to focus on it, or on some of the Medicaid cuts that are coming as well. Now, government health programs often have high sign-up rates in counties that voted for Trump in 2024, and in some cases by big margins. This is especially true of Medicaid. The news organization Axios has analyzed Medicaid data across the country and found there were equal shares of people who were covered by Medicaid in 2023 who lived in states that voted for Trump and states that voted for Democrat Kamala Harris. So with the new billing notices going out today across the country, Scott, there's a good chance that some of the political pain is going to be felt across the political spectrum as well.
NPR's Ron Elving, always a pleasure to talk to you, and particularly in a week like this with so much happening. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
The east wing of the White House has been demolished to make way for a huge ballroom that will host state dinners for up to 1,000 people. But what to do until then? I've never been to a state dinner. I have milled outside a few with other reporters to shout questions at some of the politicians and celebrities going in and out. Sometimes they smile. The menus of what's served are made public, and they sound like first-rate fare without being too daring. Heirloom tomato soup, Iowa ribeye steak, or Maine lobster, followed by maple pecan or orange chiffon cake. But as a couple of state dinner guests have told me off the record, and with respect for the talented White House kitchen crew, you don't go to a state dinner for the food. So in the pause, while the rubble that was once the East Wing is cleared away, why not move state dinners to a different location? Why not hold them at the Iowa State Fairgrounds? Yes, it would involve a flight. But if you use last summer's bill of fare as a guide, guests could walk from stand to stand instead of being stuck in their seats for speeches. They could feast on a chicken pickle ranch rocket on a stick, flaming hot Cheetos fries, a full mozzarella, Korean corn dog, maple bacon flavored cheese curds, or Fairgrounds Fiesta wontons filled with egg salad and the size of catcher's mitts, deep fried and then drizzled with hot honey and pico de gallo. Now that's America. For dessert, the Scotcheroo shake, peanut butter and butterscotch ice cream swirled with Scotcheroo fudge, which is a mix of peanut butter, butterscotch, Rice Krispies and chocolate chips crowned by whipped cream with caramel and chocolate drizzles. You can imagine diplomats and politicians staggering into their limos after a fairground state dinner, saying between belches, "We must end these tariffs and open a Scotcheroo shake trade route." And when it comes time for the toasts, heads of state can salute a long, fruitful friendship between countries with the bracing combination of pink lemonade and pickle juice known as a pickled pink. An Iowa fairground state dinner might remind us how America is a mix from all over the world, where people bring their biggest dreams and break bread, or Fiesta wontons with friends new and old. Feeling a little hungry, and you're listening to NPR News.
It's 7:18. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. Weather for today, partly sunny, highs near 42, light north winds, lows tonight near 30. Remember to set your clocks back 1 hour before you go to bed as daylight savings time is ending. Weather for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. We've been celebrating our members all week with some fun events and special programming. Tune in tonight at 6 o'clock for a special green cheese trivia for kids with Mike Spry and youngsters Mia and Alex. That's followed by regular green cheese with your volunteer host, Brandon Chase.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead, urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days, it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it, because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Thank you. climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Open enrollment begins today on healthcare.gov, the Affordable Care Act marketplace. That's where people who do not get health insurance through their job or through a public program like Medicare or Medicaid can shop for coverage. This year's sign-up season is certainly different, and NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin joins us. Thanks so much for being with us, Selena.
Hi, Scott. Good to be with you.
What do people who enroll in these plans need to know this year?
Well, they need to know that their premiums might be significantly higher. And that is because something called enhanced subsidies that Congress first passed in 2021 are expiring. And that extra help to buy health insurance is something that millions of people have relied on in the last few years. In fact, 24 million people have these plans. They're small business owners, farmers, ranchers. And as open enrollment begins this year, the federal government is shut down, and these subsidies are a central issue. Either lawmakers make a deal and premiums stay about the same as they have been this year, or they don't, and premium costs go way up.
How much could they go up?
On average, people will have to pay double next year for the same plan. That's a lot, right? But from person to person, it might be more than that. It might be less. It depends on where you live, your age, your income, and more. Also, to be clear, there will still be some federal subsidies, even if there's no deal. They just won't be as generous.
What would seem to be the best advice for people who get their health insurance this way?
Yeah, I would say the best advice is don't panic until you see what's happening with your plan in your circumstances. The source of that advice is Jeremy Smith. Obamacare open enrollment is his busiest time of the year. He works for an organization called First Choice Services in Charleston, West Virginia, and their job is to help people sign up for these plans.
We've already booked, I think, over 300 appointments.
And he says, you know, this year, people who are calling are anxious.
There's been a lot of stories about rate increases, so they are nervous. And we are just encouraging them to go through the process and look at the new plans and prices because we don't know exactly what they're going to be looking at until we do the application.
He says what you shouldn't do is be hands-off and let your current plan auto-renew because the cost for 2026 might be dramatically different.
Selena, is there a chance Congress could make a deal that would extend the enhanced subsidies?
Yeah, I would say there's a decent chance. Democrats are pushing hard to extend the subsidies, and many Republicans say they're open to a deal. The problem has just been getting everyone to the table to negotiate. So because of that, one option would be to wait to sign up for a plan for a few weeks in case lawmakers do make a deal and your options change. There is another thing, too, that I wanted to mention that's different this year that is getting a lot less attention than the premium cost increases.
And what's that?
Well, the Trump administration cut 90% from federal Navigator grants available to organizations that help people sign up for plans, like First Choice Services. They also did this in President Trump's first term. And I asked Jeremy Smith what that means for his budget.
That puts us down from around a staff of 12 to only one that's funded through the Navigator program.
They were able to get some West Virginia foundations to fund three additional staffers. They also made some changes to the website to help walk people through how to enroll by themselves.
And then, of course, some of our admin, like myself, where I haven't done a lot of enrollment work personally the last couple of years, I'll be rolling up my sleeves and, you know, I'm salary, so I'll be working as many hours as possible just to get in there and help as many people as we can.
He does say there is a silver lining to the political fight over these plans. There's a lot more awareness of open enrollment than usual. And Smith says he's happy that people are paying attention.
And Pierce Lena Simmons-Duffin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Composing emails has never been easier. AI assistants can craft messages with very little guidance from, you know, real human beings. But now some real human beings worry that emails are reading a little too perfect. And as NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, that's a concern shared by some of those working in tech.
Email assistants have taken over our inboxes. The AI-powered tools can do things like compose messages in response to simple prompts and complete people's sentences. AI-assisted email is big business too. The market for robo-missives is expected to grow to more than $4.5 billion by 2029. However, a recent Columbia University study reveals that more than half of spam emails are written by AI. And that's one reason why some tech workers are worried their AI-assisted emails will be treated as such for seeming too machine-like.
I sometimes do little typos on purpose if I want to seem human.
This is Peter Sleiman. He's the creative director of a video agency.
Forgetting a dot or maybe misspelling a word, maybe adding a smiley face the old way instead of an actual emoji like ChatGPT does, I could add the two dots with a parenthesis.
The topic of inserting deliberate errors into email came up during a session Sleiman co-led about digital marketing at the recent TechCrunch Disrupt conference in San Francisco. Fellow entrepreneur Luca Oak attended the session.
One of my favorite t-shirts is a t-shirt that says, "I am secretly judging your grammar."
Oak says she prefers that people stick to good grammar and spelling, PLZ.
Because it actually can make it really hard to take in your message when I have to wade through what did you mean here because of your typos.
Yet even Oak has her own method for humanizing email.
I lowercase all instances of I.
But beating the AI's drive for flawless sentences takes commitment.
I'm auto-corrected all the time.
Grad student Daniel Zock was also at the conference checking out the latest innovations. He says people in his network are even asking AI assistants to write in less perfect ways in an effort to seem more human.
They say, "Hey, ChatGPT, please avoid like the M dash, the N dash, all that stuff."
But Zock says he's personally fine with AI composing slickly worded emails on his behalf.
What are we trying to do? We're trying to train these systems for reaching that level of humanness. So it's not bad if the AI generates something that's very close to what a human will be outputting, right?
Zock says people shouldn't get so hung up on style. It's the content of the message that counts. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Halloween may be over, but ghost jobs are still here. Mostly they're scams in the form of text messages to your phone that offers a job that is simply too good to be true.
The scammers try to get you interested and think that you have an opportunity to make real money. They might ask you to do some simple tasks from home, and then they pay you for that. Typically what happens is they, quote, overpay you, and then that's the real scam.
How do these scams work? Listen tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha. You can tune in by turning on your radio or asking your smart speaker to play your member station by name. The film Hello Road opens in the middle of the night with shots of what looks like a hastily abandoned dinner table, shards of a broken glass below, and family photos that show a daughter and two parents smiling. A phone trills. We hear it's their 18-year-old daughter, Alice, calling with shocking news from a road deep in a forest. She ran over somebody and may have killed them.
When? When did this happen? Just now?
What's going on?
Alice, are you hurt?
Whoa, what? What? Hey.
What about the other person? Are they hurt?
Maddie, what's happened?
Is there anyone around who can help? Is there a house? Is there a car? Anybody around who can help?
Put her on.
Why not? Where are you?
I need to hear her.
Rosamund Pike and Matthew Rhys are the parents in the film directed by Babak Anvari. And Matthew Rhys, so recognizable from The Americans, Perry Mason, and so much else, joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you enormously for having me. It's always a great pleasure to be here.
Well, our pleasure. What are some of the jumbled emotions that these parents, Frank and Maddie, feel?
Oh, good grief. I mean, this is the true parental roller coaster that this 90-minute hell ride takes you on, especially those who have children will well understand. But the conceit of it was remarkable in that it's the greatest quandary as to how far you will go to protect your child. And that in itself, as a question, can elicit many extremities. In this film, they certainly come to the front.
Yeah. Do the parents feel, without giving too much away, that they did something wrong, that they're somehow responsible?
Well, that is the other element to this beautiful piece of writing whereby in both parents you have both sides of the quandary, where one is saying, but this is what we need to do to secure our child's safety. And the other partner is saying, but that is amoral and illegal, and we cannot do that. And therein lies who, you know, can you then begin to kind of quantify or qualify your love for the same child that you share? And the depths of those kind of conversations, as they take place solely inside the interior of a car over this time, makes for an intense time.
Those are very intense scenes, and as you indicate, they're all inside a car.
Mm.
And of course, I assume the set was a lot bigger than that. But what's it like to film scenes that intense in such confines?
A number of things. Exhilarating, for a start, that you have, and Babak was, the director, was incredible, or some might say sadistic, in that on the first morning of film...
a director, you know.
Well, yes, of course. The last of the, the true dictators. But he said, listen, on the first morning, I think, as a nice little warm-up or to introduce it all to the crew, a memory card on our film cameras is about 60 minutes. So I would like to do a 60-minute take of the first 60 minutes of the film. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. Do you mean to say we will basically run the first 60 minutes of the film like a one-act play? And he went, yes, exactly that. So on the first morning in front of the crew, they put the cards in and off we went. And he had the good grace and foresight to say, we will rehearse that for a week prior to that moment, like a play. But the beauty is, it's the two of you sat in a car with we're nowhere to go. And obviously, because of the nature of driving, me driving, you can't really look, you can't look at your partner. And therefore, you have this incredible moment where you're both just listening to each other. Next to each other, and how you navigate that, especially under the exercise of having to convince the other person.
Parents disagree about their daughter's explanation of events, kind of, don't they?
Yes. And what you see is Rosamund's character being in the medical field, and then my character possibly being a little more high-spirited or passionate in his kind of paternal instincts. You then have clashing against that kind of more passionate approach to parenting.
And Maddie, being a nurse, also feels she's obliged to help the person that her daughter has run over.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the Hippocratic oath that they take is to save life at all costs. But if it comes at the cost of your own offspring, that is possibly the highest price to pay.
Is this a film, it's about so much, is it also about the parental relationship and spouses, husbands, wives, partners in life?
Absolutely. It's like all great writing, really, and pardon the pun, it is truly a vehicle that shines a light or magnifies what really is going on. It intensifies those moments and magnifies it and puts the relationship quite violently under a microscope.
Yeah. And not without giving anything away, but to be seasonal, there's a deeper mystery and other voices that begin to kind of take over the journey, don't they?
There is. And that was the other element of the film that really took me by surprise. And it's a turn in the film that I truly wasn't expecting. But also, you know, ponders the question of our own psyches and our own imaginations and how much they can affect us.
Is it frightening to make a frightening film?
The truly frightening element to me was this wasn't something fantastic or, you know, phantasmic. It was the true great horror of what do you do for your child in these extreme situations? And what happens when your child is placed in an incredibly harrowing situation that you are privy to, but absolutely immobilized in what you can do to help? And that to me was the ultimate horror story, is that you have to listen, if you were to have to listen to your child going through this thing and in no way, shape or form be able to help, that is to me a true horror story.
Matthew Reese, stars alongside Rosamund Pike in Babak Anvari's new film, Hello Road. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you as always. Always a true pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Hospital chaplains often meet people who are at the lowest points in their lives, when it's not just the body that requires healing. But one chaplain gets patients to talk about their tattoos as a way to create an emotional bond. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR in Boston has the story.
When Charisse Pinckney has an attack of crippling pain, she rushes to Dana-Farber Cancer Institute for an infusion of pain medications, anti-nausea drugs, and fluids. Pinckney has a blood disorder called sickle cell disease.
Basically, my body attacks itself.
On bad days, crescent-shaped red blood cells get stuck in her organs, muscles, and joints.
So it can get pretty serious.
Pinckney was recovering from one of these attacks when she met an interfaith chaplain named Larissa Weah. Weah describes the moment during her daily rounds when she walked up to Pinckney's bed, said hello, and looked for a way to start a conversation.
I noticed there were beautiful, beautiful images on your arm. And I made a compliment that it was really meaningful what I saw.
The first tattoo Weah noticed shows a heart connected to an airplane with a quote.
Yes.
Not all who wander are lost.
Are lost, yes.
Yeah. Not all who wander are lost. It's from The Lord of the Rings.
Tolkien, the philosopher, the great writer Tolkien, found you. It was amazing. And that's how it started.
The two women discovered a deep connection.
We talked literature, we talked social issues, we talked your family history. A whole world was brought into that visit.
Pinckney has 30 tattoos. Weah has none, mostly because she's afraid of needles. But she also grew up disliking tattoos as a child in Russia, when tattoos were largely associated with criminals. And her faith, Christian Orthodox, does not encourage them. But Pinckney didn't sense any of that.
You know, sometimes people judge, but she didn't judge me, and she made me feel comfortable, so I was willing to open up to her.
I'm a stranger, but within minutes, they will give you the story. Their circle of support, of their life, of their passions, griefs.
Weah also counsels patients in hospice. She says tattoos can be a bridge between life and death, connecting a family member who is dying to those who will be left behind.
People do matching tattoos, mother-daughter tattoos, wings of butterflies, for example.
A mom close to death might have one wing of a butterfly, her daughter the other.
So it's kind of sad, but it helps them to grieve.
Kyle Christensen with the Association of Professional Chaplains says connecting with patients through their tattoos may sound unusual, but it fits a chaplain's mission.
They are looking for all kinds of evidence or ideas that they can use to connect with the patient. And that includes noticing things like tattoos.
Christensen says tattoos hold clues about who the patient is outside of their illness, and sometimes even their core beliefs.
It can be both an entry point into the patient's life, as well as a great way to learn more about what they're going through.
Pinckney is still living with sickle cell disease. But now, whenever she checks into the hospital, Weah is part of her care team.
I feel like I've known her a lifetime, I tell you. She comes to see me, and it just warms my heart because it's like she cares about me.
That's the connection Weah aims for as a chaplain. She knows that some of her colleagues may not be comfortable using tattoos as a window to the soul, but she's convinced there are few better ways to understand what's underneath the skin. For NPR News, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:39. Good morning. You're listening to Weekend Edition on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock on Stay Human, true stories of visitations from the other side with great music, too. That is this morning at 9, or you can catch it tomorrow evening at 5. Support for KAXC comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Partly sunny today, highs near 42, light north winds, lows tonight near 30. Remember to set your clocks back 1 hour before you go to bed tonight. And tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. And looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs near 50 with breezy west winds. Mesabi Symphony Orchestra kicks off its season tonight, 7 o'clock at Rock Ridge Performing Arts Center in Virginia. Find more info and tickets at MesabiSymphonyOrchestra.org. More news is next.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. FBI Director Kash Patel says authorities have busted a plot for a violent Halloween weekend attack. Posting on social media, Patel says several people in Michigan were arrested in connection with the case. Delays continue at airports across the nation amid air traffic control staffing shortages. With the government shutdown now on day 32, most controllers are continuing to work mandatory overtime 6 days a week without pay during the shutdown. Israel says identification procedures show remains of three people handed over by Hamas to the Red Cross this week do not belong to any of the hostages. Remains of 11 hostages still remain in Gaza. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Millions of Americans wake up today uncertain whether they will receive their SNAP benefits in the coming days. But the government shutdown isn't just affecting food assistance. Grants to help low-income families pay for their heating bills are also on hold. Sophia Schmidt from member station WHYY has more.
Justina Ray lives in a gray shingle duplex just north of Philadelphia with her two kids and a black cat.
What's the kid's name?
Flounder.
Ray teaches preschool, and she struggles to afford her heating bills in the winter.
So my income itself comes down with all the holidays and the school closures and things like that.
For nearly a decade, Ray has relied on the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, to pay most of her winter heating bills. The program provides billions of dollars in grants to about 6 million households nationwide to help them pay their energy bills, buy fuel, or fix broken heaters. The Department of Health and Human Services sends most of these funds to states around this time each year to run the program. But because of the shutdown, this hasn't happened. So Pennsylvania has delayed the start of its LIHEAP program by a month. WAFAM works at Pennsylvania's Department of Human Services. She says the state has some cash on hand, but it's not enough. FAM says the state needs a guarantee that more federal funding is coming.
I would consider it really detrimental for us to start a program and then lose funding and then have to close it.
Pennsylvania is one of several states that have announced delays or disruptions to their programs due to the shutdown. A few others, like Alaska and Massachusetts, are using money left from last season to give emergency assistance. Some are preparing to use state funding to fill the gap.
This is unprecedented.
Mark Wolf leads the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, which represents state agencies that run LIHEAP. He says most states will need federal funding to fully open their programs. Even after the shutdown ends, Wolf says it could take weeks for the federal government to release the funds. And he worries the process will be slow because the Trump administration fired the staff that administer LIHEAP this spring.
Even if they do that, we will be delayed until December before we see any of the money. And it could be into January. So we're very, very worried about that because winter starts.
Department of Health and Human Services Press Secretary Emily Hilliard said in an emailed statement that once the government reopens, the agency will work swiftly to administer the funds. FAM says, in the meantime, Pennsylvania families will be left with fewer resources.
Families will be faced with a choice, potentially in the month of November, as to whether or not to heat their homes or to put food on the table or to make payments on other bills.
For Justina Ray, that may mean missing a car payment or traveling less to visit family over the holidays. She says she's already behind on her energy bills.
Like, we've got extra blankets heated up. If, like, we'll maybe have the oven open a little bit.
And she's not planning to turn her heat on anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania.
The Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office has an unusual unit, a team dedicated to representing people who have cognitive disabilities. It's built on the premise that prison is often not the right place for someone with this type of impairment. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson has the story.
A few years ago, Noah Cox started to notice something about many of the people he was representing in court.
I wanted to know their account of what happened, and I'd ask them questions.
Cox is a lawyer in the LA County Public Defender's Office.
And many of them would struggle with a basic explanation. And it seemed like they were having challenges related to some sort of intellectual ability.
What Cox was seeing was indicative of a broader pattern. Studies show people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are overrepresented in the nation's prisons and jails. Those are conditions that limit learning and reasoning, like Down syndrome and fetal alcohol syndrome. Without support, a person with this kind of impairment might have trouble keeping a job, living independently, knowing who's a friend and who isn't. Once they're behind bars, they're in a system that isn't built for them. They might come out worse off. Cox wanted to disrupt that cycle.
Our team is often the first time that somebody is accurately diagnosed. It is sad to me that a lot of my clients at age 30, 40, 50 are being diagnosed for the first time by the criminal legal system.
It's one of the only public defense teams of its kind in the country, partly, Cox says, because it takes a lot of resources to do this kind of work. Which brings us to Jimmy. We're not using his last name because he and his family worried about the stigma of his record.
I'm 56 years old. I was born and raised in East LA.
Jimmy is wiry, with tattoos on his neck and glasses that are a little too big for his face. For as long as he can remember, he's been getting in trouble with family, with teachers, with the police.
I couldn't control myself. I wasn't aware of my sicknesses. I wasn't aware of anything, really, you know, that anything was even wrong, you know?
He has been homeless and struggled with drug abuse, and he's been in and out of prison most of his life for various crimes. Cox remembers the first time Jimmy came to his office on a burglary charge.
He was trying very hard to tell me something that was very important to him, but I could not understand what he was trying to say.
It was his third strike, meaning he already had two violent felonies on his record. Now he could face a much harsher sentence. After some initial testing by a neuropsychologist,
it became apparent that this was somebody who had a developmental disability who had not been identified when he was young.
Cox, plus a small team of paralegals, interns, and social workers, wanted to make the case that a diversion program, an alternative to prison, would be a better fit for Jimmy. And that would be easier with a diagnosis. So the team gathered as many records as they could and interviewed Jimmy's family to get a sense of his childhood, including his sister Sylvia.
They were actually trying to help him, and it was very new to us.
Sylvia always knew something was different about her brother. He was late to crawl, late to speak. He couldn't do his paper route on his own. He struggled in school. She says he started getting in trouble with the police before he even hit his teen years.
I think it was a self-fulfilling prophecy for him. The more he was labeled bad, I think the more he became bad.
After all the interviews and tests, Jimmy was diagnosed with a mild intellectual disability.
We always knew it. So it was very validating.
That diagnosis made Jimmy eligible for disability services in California. After a lot of discussion with his family, Jimmy chose to seek diversion in his burglary case, and the prosecutor and judge approved. On a sunny day in LA's Ladera Park, Jimmy is going through his workout routine.
I do my push-ups right here, probably like 50, and you feel it burn, you know?
He comes to this park almost every day with a program that works with adults with disabilities. Lately, his days are looking a lot different than they used to. He lives in a group home, goes to therapy. He's a third of the way through his 2-year diversion.
All I can see is that it offers more than prison has to offer me, you know, because I've just changed my life completely. I don't even use drugs anymore. I'm not homeless anymore. I'm not frustrated anymore. I traded in my life for a new one.
Each time he got out of prison, he felt like he'd take one step forward, then 3 steps back. Now, with a lot of support, he's viewing his life as a clean slate. And Cox says that's the point.
Jimmy himself made a decision that he wanted to invest in his future. This is his opportunity for a real life.
And hopefully, Cox says, he's the last lawyer Jimmy will ever need. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Bea Wilson's new book begins when a baking pan, heart-shaped, falls at her feet shortly after her marriage has ended. 23 years before, she'd used it to bake her wedding cake. What follows is a book that considers and cherishes everyday kitchen goods, a plate from childhood, an old rotary whisk, corkscrews, and why they're so often the source of everlasting memories. Bea Wilson, the acclaimed British food writer, joins us from London. Her new book, The Heart-Shaped Tin, Love, Loss, and Kitchen Objects. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Help us appreciate what that heart-shaped tin set off in you.
It was something that I had bought with so much hope to bake my own wedding cake in. And then when it fell at my feet a couple of months after he left, out of the blue, I felt this was a sign. I thought it was telling me something. And at the same time as I had that thought, I also thought, I'm going crazy. It can't be telling me something. It's an inanimate object. And I think those two feelings together were really what set me off to write this book, which was, how can we look at something that's made of metal in a factory by people we've never met before and think that it's somehow an extension of ourselves?
Well, we hold that object in our hands and often do something with it that's in our hearts.
Absolutely. We touch these things, and they're woven into our families and our relationships.
Please tell us about your mother's silver-plated toast rack, important to her. And then she was convinced it had been stolen, right?
My mother suddenly started talking about the fact she thought that someone had stolen her silver-plated toast rack, which was an extremely valuable object to her. Like many British people, her day would not be complete without a piece of toast in the morning. And one day she told me and my son someone's stolen it and that she'd reported it to the police and they'd politely listened to her. And then we didn't want to sound too sceptical because she got so angry with us every time we said, are you sure someone's stolen it? But she would elaborate the story and say, well, the thief must have leapt over her fence in one bound and must have wanted to have a picnic. And clearly the more she told this story, the more it became clear to us that she was in the early stages of dementia. And one of the first stages of dementia for many people is you develop this paranoia that someone's stealing from you. And then over the coming months, she forgot she'd ever had a toast rack. I moved her to a care home to be closer to me. And then, sorry, I forgive me if I get tearful. I can't talk about this subject without getting very emotional.
Yeah.
We cleared her house eventually because she was in the care home and she was never going to go back. And then my sister was the one who eventually found that toast rack at the back of a cupboard.
You noticed a kitchen cabinet in the news one day.
Yes, this is about Ukraine. So this was a kitchen object that became celebrated from a different emotion from the sadness of the toast rack. It was lionized for its courage and its bravery, and it became a piece of kind of pro-Ukrainian propaganda, more or less, in the early days of the Russian invasion in 2022. An apartment block was more or less completely bombed out, and yet on the inner wall of one of the apartments, there was a kitchen cabinet that just clung on to the side of this block of buildings as if for dear life. And it became a meme. People were putting these slogans out on social media saying, be brave like this kitchen cabinet, hang on like the kitchen cabinet. And eventually the woman who owned the apartment was tracked down and she just said her son had put this cabinet up and he'd clearly done a very good job. But it's another example of how we look at something that can't have feelings. And maybe it's safer to consider the feelings of a kitchen cabinet than it is to think about what so many Ukrainians themselves were suffering at just that moment.
You have a heart-piercing section too on a spoon, Jacob Chaim's spoon.
Yes, I found this perhaps the most moving story in the whole book. It's now in the Montreal Holocaust Museum. Jacob Chaim, he was a Polish tailor before the war. He and his brother both ended up in Dora Mittelbau. It was a particularly hellish place. And in common with other concentration camps, food was both inadequate, disgusting, nutritionally just awful, and served without any cutlery because the Nazi guards wanted to treat the inmates as if they weren't human, as if they were animals. And cutlery is so fundamental to civilization. So what Jacob Chaim did when no one was looking, he stole pieces of metal which were meant for making weaponry for the Nazis and made this little spoon for himself. And he didn't just make any spoon. He wanted to make a thing of beauty. And after the war, thankfully, he and his brother survived. He would talk to his family about it was about being human.
Can I ask about your heart-shaped tin now?
Yeah, after it fell to the ground and I was feeling so heartbroken and thinking, this is a sad tin belonging to a sad person. Almost all of my friends, I told the story of it leaping out in front of my feet to, said, you should have a giant divorce party or a separation party and bake yourself a cake in it. And I just didn't feel ready. But then life moves on. And the great theme of the book is that objects can change their meaning because we can change our emotions about them. And a few years on, my 50th birthday came around and I thought, I will bake a cake. And it honestly felt like a different object. The strangest thing was I'd inflated it in my mind to this huge, colossal cake tin that would be fit for gods or heroes. And then when I picked it up, it was just quite small. And we managed to finish the cake and I will use it again.
I was especially struck when you advised, and I must say, it's something that I hear from my wife. If you don't use the best china now, you may never use it.
It's hard to know if that's a happy thought or a sad one, isn't it? But I do think it's true. You may as well use it now. Who knows what's ahead? And if you've been given something beautiful by someone you love, the best way to honor them is use it.
Bea Wilson's new book, The Heart-Shaped Tin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Use it right now. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It is just before 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can also find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region, coming up at 9 o'clock. Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. A mix of stories and songs. This week, Tales from the Other Side. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Weather for today, partly sunny, highs near 42, light north winds, lows tonight near 30. Do remember to set your clocks back before you go to bed tonight. Daylight savings time is ending. Weather for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. Support comes from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses. Working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce, learn more at itascadv.org.